Hi, today we're here talking with Callie Gazy, a UCLA anthropology student who's recently conducted fieldwork. Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Hello. Yeah. So through the UCLA Lemelson program, I spent 6 weeks over the summer of 2019 conducting research within a transitional housing facility for women released from prisons and jails in Texas. I was interested to see how women were handling this process and what aspects of the program led to success.
How did you become interested in this topic?
Honestly, I came from a place of privilege where no one in my family or close circle has been incarcerated. I never had to consider this issue. I had ill-informed assumptions about the ease of this transition without knowledge of the parole system and the conflicts it can raise for people. So when I heard certain statistics about the rising population of incarcerated women, I became motivated to learn more.
What do you mean by the parole system making this transition harder?
Well, the parole system is described as a supervised release. So individuals have parole conditions. For example, not living with anyone with a felony, not leaving a certain geographical area, attending substance abuse classes, etc. On average, a parolee faces 15 conditions. Some have to pay for their own drug testing and classes, have to attend multiple required meetings a day, and have to care for children on top of maintaining a steady job. With limited access to transportation and money, they may not be able to pay for, attend, and complete all programs necessary for parole. So they return to prison. Most women in the program I studied were released on parole. Most had no form of identification, and some suffered from physical and mental health problems, making finding a job more difficult. If they failed to uphold these requirements, they face rearrest. It's a very stressful situation for people, especially considering the demographics of this population.
What are the demographics?
They vary by state, but I studied a population of female inmates in a metropolitan city of Texas. The majority of inmates in this city made less than $10,000 per year prior to arrest, and 81% are mothers. 82% of the women are victims of domestic violence, and a staggering 58% were sexually abused as children, most with multiple abusers. About a quarter were at one point sex workers, and about half have a mental illness diagnosis. Also, the prison population is 22% Black, even though Black Americans only constitute 6% of the population in this city. There's an element of targeted and structural violence occurring with poor, already marginalized women of color. So while the behaviors that landed these women in prison are frowned upon by society, what we're really dealing with are severely traumatized individuals with very few options.
Wow, that sounds so hard.
Yeah, it puts people in a very difficult position that most are unaware of. A common cycle of arrest and incarceration surrounds drug use. Drug rehabilitation programs are not easily available to most previously incarcerated individuals, and society as a whole has very little patience for addicts, despite what we know about the difficulty of addiction. Most women in this program were incarcerated for drug use, sex work, and petty theft, which are all connected. Previous research shows that women often enter this cycle of drug use to self-soothe PTSD and disassociate from trauma.
What is being done about this problem? Is there any government support?
Yes. So reentry programs or transitional housing facilities are organizations designed to smooth the transition, provide resources, and help women find housing and job opportunities. Historically, these programs have not addressed the psychological reasons for incarceration, but there are some nonprofit holistic organizations that provide individual and group therapy, which is more successful at interrupting the cycle of incarceration. This type of program and the women it served were the focus of my research.
What do you mean when you say the programs are holistic?
These programs are not quick housing-only programs where women are pushed through the program at the same time and expected to adjust, maintain sobriety, and get a job in that time. Women who finish the program I studied usually stay over a year and are treated on a case-by-case basis. They undergo therapy, substance abuse classes, and job training classes, but also have classes designed to address the emotional, physical, and spiritual aspects of their experience. They practice art, writing, yoga, tai chi, and have prayer groups and Bible studies.
So what did your research process entail?
I spent 6 weeks doing participant observation fieldwork in which I sat with women through their classes, AA meetings, and group therapy, as well as Bible study, meals, game nights, movie nights, and other activities around the facility. I did not supervise individual therapy. Still, I got to experience a day in the life within the program, interviewing many residents and staff and forming strong bonds with them. I quickly became aware of the incredible, difficult lives some of these women led and became interested and invested in their personal growth through the curriculum provided.
What was interesting about the curriculum?
The therapist on staff was trained as a professional counselor, marriage and family therapist, and chemical dependency counselor, and had been working within the program for 17 years. So while she conducted individualized therapy, she also included teachings that stem from Dr. Brené Brown's shame resilience therapy. This became the focus of my study because I quickly became aware of its value.
Can you tell me more about shame resilience?
Shame resilience is a class taught by the therapist in which residents spent time sitting in a group learning about the differences between guilt and shame. This is the difference. Guilt is, I've done something wrong. Shame is, I've done something wrong because I am wrong. So learning the difference is key because the way we talk about ourselves determines our future behavior. The second part of the class is about expressing shame. What surprised me is that while the conversations varied in specific details, they were not very different from the conversations between me and my friends. We all had shame about our bodies and appearances, our intelligence, our sexual ability or preferences, our perceived failures. They were all really universal issues. Every woman had an invisible, perfect version of herself that was a constant rival. Yet when we spoke these shames out loud, the shame lost some of its power. It was no longer an isolating force. Sharing was exhilarating, and most were able to laugh at some aspects of their situation, and it made approaching those issues easier.
How did it affect residents?
What I found was that the shame resilience curriculum influenced women's sense of psychological safety, their connection to others, and their emotional intelligence.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. So psychological safety means that someone feels comfortable expressing who they are without fear of negative repercussions. The shared shame helped create friendships and trust beyond residents. Though some women didn't approve of themselves, they now had a group of women who didn't judge them. It provided a big perspective shift. And emotional intelligence is one's ability to identify, manage, and express both positive and negative emotions. The dynamics of prison and lots of unsafe environments are such that exposing this vulnerability is unsafe. So people emotionally shut down, numb themselves, or disassociate from their emotions. This class helped women identify different emotions and where they start in the body as physical sensations.
Why is that important?
This class was critically important because I witnessed women coming to understand their emotional experiences in a way they never had before. Residents often explain that they didn't even know how they felt. For example, they didn't know they were angry. They'd been angry since they were children and couldn't clearly see for so long how that was playing out in their behaviors. One resident explained to the therapist that shame felt like a big, heavy coat. And in addressing her shame about her convictions, her past actions, and her perception of herself, she was shedding a heavy coat. She was lighter and felt relief.
Wow, amazing. Can you go deeper into why it's important that we become more emotionally intelligent?
Research shows that the way we tell our stories of our lives impacts the way we behave in the future. This is called narrative making. If someone decides they're a certain kind of person, they're more likely to behave in a way that is congruent with that story. A woman in the program explained that she used to be the queen of chaos, and that was just who she was. Her behavior aligned with that story. Through her rehabilitation, she explained that she's uncovered a woman she's proud of. The way she tells her story now is that, as she calls, her years in hell have made her strong. They've helped her find herself. This narrative shift is so important.
What are the big takeaways from your research?
The first and most important is that these women are worthy of rehabilitation. They are a critical but unseen part of our community that are not being taken care of. Secondly, the justice system is targeting marginalized populations, and it's important to be aware of this injustice. The system is not currently adept at interrupting this cycle of incarceration. I also believe that stopping this targeted, institutionalized violence against women is a shared issue that we're all responsible for taking part in. It's our duty to amend the system we've inherited.
Sometimes it seems really difficult to affect structural problems facing our communities with our personal actions. So I guess the last question that I want to ask is, what can we do to help?
You are right. Policy reform and institutional change takes time. However, there are many things we can do to be advocates and support positive change. Progressive voting that challenges private prisons, mandatory minimums, voter restrictions, inhumane prison treatment, and predatory bail processes is very important. If you can't vote, you can support through social action, such as volunteering, donating, supporting felon-friendly businesses, and bringing more awareness to the issue. And on a personal level, I think we all need to investigate the negative assumptions we have about people we may not understand. Working against the stigma of incarceration, addiction, and sex work goes a long way in changing the way we think about and treat other people. We're a lot more similar than we are different.
Callie, thanks so much for talking about your research.
Thanks for talking to me about this. I also want to thank Dr. Rob Lemelson, Dr. Philippe Bourgois, the Lemelson professors, and the entire UCLA Anthropology Department for helping to put this together.